Thank you very much, Jill, and a very warm welcome from me here at the Royal Albert Hall for tonight's prom, which is being given by the London Philharmonic Orchestra under their principal conductor, Vladimir Yurovsky. He's still in his late 30s. He's been principal conductor of the LPO for the past 4 years, and in that time he's programmed an eclectic mix of music at the orchestra's home on London's South Bank. He's also the music director of the Glyndebourne Festival Opera, and I'm sure his theatrical skills will be very much to the fore in tonight's prom, especially perhaps in the second half when we celebrate the 200th anniversary of Franz Liszt's birth. We'll be hearing the work that many consider to be Liszt's orchestral masterpiece, his hour-long Faust Symphony. In the first half, the award-winning pianist Jean-Eflamme Bavouzet joins the orchestra for a performance of the playfully barbed first piano concerto by Liszt's younger compatriot and admirer too, Béla Bartók. But first, Bartók's companion in collecting Hungarian folk material, a great music educator too, Zoltán Kodály, and a nostalgic and lively set of orchestral dances, the Dances of Galanta. I say nostalgic because the folk music that they're based on comes from an area where Kodály spent some of the happiest years of his childhood, the western Hungarian village of Galanta. The town band there was led by the fiddler Midhók, who was famous towards the end of the 19th century, but it must have been even more famous 100 or so years earlier. Several volumes of Hungarian dances were published in Vienna around the year 1800, and one of them lists its source as coming from several gypsies in Galanta. As a child in the area, Kodály not only had ample opportunities to hear Midhók's band, he also learned the many folk songs sung to him by servants and schoolmates. So the process of composing this lovely suite of dances must have marked something of a musical homecoming. Well, that applause for Vladimir Yurovsky, who now conducts the London Philharmonic Orchestra in the Dances of Galanta by Zoltán Kodály.
Thank you.
Well, I don't think it would have got too much prompting to have the arena start dancing to that music. The Dancers of Galanta by Zoltán Kodály, that incredibly spirited performance by the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Vladimir Yurovsky. You know, he's an incredible rehearser. I watched him rehearsing this morning, and he's just cueing, I must tell you, the lead clarinetist, Nicholas Carpenter, who did that beautiful solo at the beginning of the piece. But he's a stickler for detail and also balancing the orchestra. He gets them to play almost like chamber music players, to listen to each other. And in that respect, he reminded me of the great George Sell. He does section rehearsals as well, which is very interesting, so that nothing is left to chance, but the end result is incredibly spontaneous. Well, next this evening, music by Kodály's great compatriot, Béla Bartók, a rather more outspoken composer than Kodály, whose innovations and imaginative sound world would have a lasting influence on the rest of the musical century, well into the 21st century, in fact. Bartók's concertos in particular are extremely original works. The first of them, a violin concerto that was dedicated to a violinist who Bartók was in love with. The last of them, a virtuoso concerto for the entire orchestra. The three piano concertos, however, feature Bartók's own instrument, though he only lived long enough to play the first two himself. This year's Proms gives us a chance to hear all three of these piano concertos, a third, which András Schiff played at last Thursday's Prom, and which you can still hear via the BBC iPlayer, was his last but one concerto, written when he was mortally ill. The first, which we'll be hearing tonight, is a work with which Bartók broke what was, in effect, a significant creative silence. It's a very different animal to the third, and animal is how a lot of people would probably have heard it when it was premiered at the 5th Festival of the International Society for Contemporary Music in Frankfurt on July the 1st in 1927. As I mentioned earlier, tonight's soloist is the Frenchman Jean-Ephraim Bavouzet. He's recorded all three Bartók concertos to great critical acclaim recently, and he's obviously had Bartók's richly varied sound world in his bloodstream for quite some time. Listening to the Bartók First Concerto, it seems to take us from the Sex Pistols to Liszt and all the way back again.
Yes. And Bach also.
And Bach. Yes. Can you remember when you first heard it, what sort of impact it had on you?
You ask me a question I'm almost embarrassed to answer, because as amazing as it is, the first Bartók piece I heard was a rock and roll arrangement of Allegro Barbaro by the famous group in the 70s, called Emerson, Lake and Palmer. And so that was my very first contact
Bartók music. I wasn't so wrong with the Sex Pistols.
Not at all, you were very close. But I just want to add, it's not by coincidence that some years later, I have met a Hungarian girl, which eventually became the mother of my two Hungarian-speaking daughters. Uh-huh. So, since 30 years, I hear a lot of Hungarian-speaking at home.
Do you hear humor in this piece?
Oh, a lot. Although we know very well that Bartók was not really a small talk person, you know. Even if he laughed, or has some irony, it's never gratis, it's never facile, easy, you know. In that aspect, one might, although this description is a little nonsense, but I heard it applied to other composers where I didn't think it fit. I'm speaking now about the description of the Beethoven of the 20th century. But if this applies to any of the 20th century, I think it should apply to Bartók, for reason that he was really aware of putting all human, you know, all together in a highly spiritual way, and of joy and hope. Meaning that joy is never easy to reach. It's a combat, of course, in Beethoven music always, a fight, you know, to fight for joy. And finally you reach it.
Jean-Ephraim Bavouzet speaking there. Well, Bartók's first piano concerto is barbed, angular, playful, and yes, in a sense, animalistic, and even now, more modern-sounding than a good many works that appeared up to and beyond the Second World War. The first movement is based on two separate motives. Initially, that pounding rhythm that I alluded to, though the melodic element gains greater and greater importance as the movement progresses. The second movement is perhaps the strangest and makes a feature of the fact that, according to the printed score, and here I quote, the percussion, including timpani, must be placed directly next to the piano, that is, behind the piano. Well, tonight it's actually behind the pianist. So much for the placement of the instruments, but what about the actual music? Well, as it happens, all three of Bartók's piano concertos have at their centre examples of his so-called night music, atmospheric nocturnes suggestive of moonlight, rustling leaves, and all manner of nightlife in miniature shimmering in the darkened forests. In the second concerto, peacefulness is shattered by frantic rushing. In the third, prayer alternates with birdsong at dawn, but in this first piano concerto, the slow movement has the piano and percussion provide a near minimalist backdrop for a dour and dissonant woodwind melody. And how is the mood broken? By the percussion who rudely gatecrash with bright lights, raise the alarm, and we're off on a wild motorized scamper of fast and lively rondo, which towards the end admits something we'd not been too aware of previously, an element of warmth. At one point the temperature warms a little and Bartók almost seems to be saying to us, this is, after all, a piano concerto. Also, I am Hungarian. Well, you want to see the percussion lineup here. It's going to take, four players, both sides of the piano. And the applause now for the tuning, which is about to start. It's precision-tooled music, this. I was listening this morning, and the players of the percussion in particular really have their work cut out. The rhythms are fairly complicated. Bartók himself wrote of the work, my first concerto, I consider it a successful work, although its style is up to a point difficult, perhaps even very difficult for the orchestra and for the public. Well, to help you prepare for those difficulties, I can tell you that when I first heard it, I thought it stark, baldly rhythmic, and sounded like a primitive war dance. That, at least, was the opening. Well, that applause is for tonight's soloist, the Bartókian with a fine pedigree, Jean-Ephraim Bavouzet, and for the conductor, Vladimir Jurovsky, who together with the London Philharmonic Orchestra performed Bartók's tough, confrontational, but ultimately rather endearing first piano concerto. Thank you. Well, that was dangerous stuff. Incredible performance of Bartók's first piano concerto. I say incredible, not just because of the brilliance of Jean-Éphelin Babouzet's playing, but he played the whole work from memory. Just as brilliant in rehearsal this morning. Vladimir Yurovsky conducting the London Philharmonic Orchestra. Tremendously spirited playing from everybody. Made the work sound incredibly fresh. You know, earlier on when I was talking to Babouzet, I asked him, I said, now, if the metronome marking on the score said one thing and your intuition said something else, what would you do? And he said, quite simple, I wouldn't play the piece. Now, there's integrity for you. And they're coming back now. Yurovsky applauding Babouzet. He shakes hands with the percussionists, waves to the timpanist to the other side of the piano. And the whole orchestra remains seated. Yurovsky as well, while they applaud. That was quite a display. Now they get up, because they gave a pretty good account of themselves as well. It's wonderful to be able to hear all the concertos here at the Proms. They're real masterpieces. But the first gets an airing less frequently than the others. And in a performance like that, which I suppose, although it stresses the modernist elements as well, brings a bit of jazz to it, makes it sound so accessible. Now Babouzet comes back on his own. Ah, an encore. a little premonition of the second half of tonight's Bond. Music by Liszt. That was Invocation, the first piece from Harmonie Poétique et Religieuse by Liszt. The first version there played by Jean-Ephraim Barbouzet, a master tone painter, as you could hear from that performance. Wonderful in Debussy's, recorded all Debussy's piano works to great acclaim, as well as the Bartok I mentioned earlier. And he returns now. Applause from the audience, cheers as well, of course, and from the orchestra. I was just thinking while I was listening to that, there's so much Liszt that we don't know terribly well. It'd be lovely to hear it performed. Well, in 20 minutes or so, the ultimate confrontation between the thinking man and the devil in Liszt's A Faust Symphony. And the figure of Faust was the subject for this evening's Proms Plus literary event, hosted today by Matthew Sweet.
Hello, and welcome to the Royal College of Music, separated from its big sister, the Royal Albert Hall, by a mere zebra crossing. Tonight, we're going to examine the terms of the most seductive and appalling contractual engagement in the history of human culture. I know what you're thinking, this is a bit out of date, Jonathan Ross has moved to ITV, but bear with us, because our focus tonight is on Faust, his deal with Mephistopheles, and the detail that devil was in. Although it was already an old story when Christopher Marlowe wrote his version, that central premise, the idea of a Faustian pact, is pretty vigorous today. Just in the last few days, I've read it used to describe the understanding between Mrs. Thatcher and Rupert Murdoch, between Tony Blair and Rupert Murdoch, and between Kerry Katona and ITV2. To help us negotiate its killer clauses are two men who know what it is to sell a soul. One of this country's greatest actors, Simon Callow, has starred in Goethe's Faust, written an introduction to Turgenev's version of the story, but I'm told it's not true that he signed a contract in blood when he appeared in Ace Ventura, When Nature Calls. The playwright and librettist, Mark Ravenhill, is a pioneer of in-your-face theatre, and like Faust, he's particularly big in Germany. Among his early works is a play called Faust is Dead. They've each chosen readings from versions of the story, which will be performed tonight by the actor John Rowe. Please welcome them all. This figure, Faust, seems to have surfaced first in German chapbooks in the 1580s. The second half of tonight's prom is Franz Liszt's Faust Symphony from 1857. These are events from a long time ago, but still, Simon Callow, we seem to need the idea of the Faustian.
Yeah, it's interesting because the essential idea of Faust is that he sells his soul to the devil. Now, we allegedly in our times don't believe either in souls or in devils, and yet it's a very potent concept, isn't it? And I must say, when I played Faust at the Lyric Hammersmith a long time ago, 20-something years ago, and I made the contract and the blood flowed and Mephistopheles took the blood and endorsed it with his own, I did feel a most extraordinary chill every night, a very scary feeling that I'd possibly parted with something of incomputable importance in order to get something. And that was that's the key of it, isn't it? And that's very disturbing.
So why do we still feel this, Mark, then? Simon says this is an increasingly secular age. There's a whole generation of thinkers who are trying to argue the soul out of existence.
I was just remembering, I played Dr. Faust when I was at sixth form college. I totally forgot about that. And Simon has exactly described that feeling. I mean, obviously, my performance is nothing like Simon Callow's. But I played Faustus and a guy called Paul Putner, who's now become a comedian, who's in lots of Little Britain sketches, played Mephistopheles. And I remember exactly that feeling. It was Marlowe's Dr. Faustus. There is something in that scene where even in a terrible sixth form production, where there's that palpable feeling in the room. I think as much as the pact with the devil, it's basic human instinct. We want more. We want to know more. We want to get beyond what our bodies can do, what our minds can do. And as long as human beings have that essential striving for, I want something beyond what I know and what I have, then I think we're always going to find some kind of connection with that Faust myth.
So is this what's happening, Simon, at that moment? A boundary is being crossed, and yet it's something ineffably human.
Yes. I mean, I don't think, although what we've both described obviously is part of the reason for the intense power of this myth, I think the myth starts with Faust's essential dissatisfaction. And that's the thing that is probably more fully elaborated in Goethe's Faust than in Marlowe's, which is an odd kind of a ragbag of a play, apart from these extraordinary scenes with the devil. But the idea of this, it's such a modern feeling, of the impossibility of finding satisfaction. What do we do to get satisfaction? And Faust, in Goethe's play particularly, runs through every conceivable pleasure, intellectual pastime, game, whatever, in order to feel fully alive. And the very interesting premise of Goethe's Faust is that he says, when they've finally done the deal and the pact, he says, I will not be yours, he says to Mephistopheles, until I've said, I am now satisfied.
Well, let's hear from Goethe's version of this contract, and John Rowe is going to read for us. And this is the moment at which the deal with Mephistopheles is done.
Poor devil, have you anything to give? Did any mighty spirit ever live that you could fathom in all your length of days? Yours is the bread that cannot satisfy. Your gold runs through the hand like mercury. Yours is the game that no one wins who plays. The girl you've given me would, while she was mine, eye up the man next door, and the divine joy of ambition falls like a shooting star. Where are the fruits that rot before they're picked? Where are the trees that put forth new green every day? The day your flattering lies persuade me to think well of myself, the day that I become a slave to pleasures that degrade me, that day's my last. I'll be content to die. Is it a wager? Done. Done? Done. And done. If ever as time flows by us, I should say, this moment is so beautiful. Let it stay.
Thank you very much, John. What kind of agreement is the Faustian Pact, Mark? For any of literature's Faustuses, Dr. Faustuses, is it a deal worth doing?
Well, I think one of the odd things about it is there's this need to know more and experience more, and then when Faust actually has that opportunity, so much of his time is occupied by, in a way, quite banal things. He wants to get drunk and he wants to have sex and quite kind of ordinary things, in a way, that he's been denied as an academic. So it's this odd mixture of wanting to know everything and own everything, and yet actually often, when you get that opportunity, the kind of banality almost of the choices that you make.
So, Simon, who is Faust exactly? What sort of character is he?
Essentially, he's a scholar. That's the point. He's an intellectual. He's somebody who's spent his life with books. He knows everything. We have to understand that. In Goethe's Faust, he's, 99. He's actually spent an entire lifetime mastering every kind of knowledge, both just ordinary factual scientific knowledge and esoteric knowledge, philosophical knowledge, and so on. He is the quintessential student, the perpetual student. And in the end, he says, it doesn't get you anywhere. Knowledge doesn't get you anywhere. What you need is power. And that's the deal. That's the terrible deal with Mephistopheles. And Mephistopheles has the power, of course, to transcend the flesh, so he can make him young again in a second. He can give him anything he wants at all. He can fly him across the world. He can fly him to other universes. He goes back into the classical world. He has an affair with Helen of Troy. And he becomes an engineer. He can do anything. He can change the world in all kinds of ways. So that really is the deal. And it's... something, I mean, that was said a great deal at the time, for example, of the atom bomb, the discovery of the atom bomb, that this was a quintessential Faustian pact, is that we bought power. We bought the power to end the war and possibly to do things for good. But what was the price?
So, Mark, this is a story about the transfer of power.
Yeah, and, you know, I've got a feeling we might be reaching one of those moments again. I think if we don't want to know more, and if we're not always reaching out and exploring, then we're not human. But there's always that fear that we're just going to overreach too far and we're going to wreak devastation. And the atomic moment was one of those moments. But I think now with genetics and stem cells and all of that, there's a real sense of, are we actually going to explode what human beings are and move into this kind of post-human state where we've absolutely destroyed what humanity is? So I think we're at a kind of Faustian moment with science at the moment.
Well, I want to pursue that idea of the scientific overreacher. Mark, you've chosen a Faustian reading from Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which John Rowe is now going to read for us.
I do not ever remember to have trembled at a tale of superstition or to have feared the apparition of a spirit. Darkness had no effect upon my fancy, and a churchyard was to me merely the receptacle of bodies deprived of life, which, from being the seat of beauty and strength, had become food for the worm. Now I was led to examine the cause and progress of this decay, and forced to spend days and nights in vaults and charnel houses. My attention was fixed upon every object the most insupportable to the delicacy of human feelings. I saw how the fine form of man was degraded and wastes. I beheld the corruption of death succeed to the blooming cheek of life. I saw how the worm inherited the wonders of the eye and brain. I paused, examining and analyzing all the minutiae of causation as exemplified in the change from life to death and death to life, until from the midst of this darkness, a sudden light broke in upon me, a light so brilliant and wondrous, yet so simple, that while I became dizzy with the immensity of the prospect which it illustrated, I was surprised that among so many men of genius who had directed their inquiries towards the same science, that I alone should be reserved to discover so astonishing a secret.
Thank you, John. So, Mark, if Frankenstein is a Faustian figure, who is his bargain with?
I guess with himself, essentially. Mary Shelley wrote that a decade after Goethe's Faust Part 1 was published, and he was a big influence on the Romantics. And I think it's interesting that Mary Shelley starts the story in Germany, but Faust actually makes a journey into the Lake District to carry on his experiments. She's trying to make that link with the German Romantics and with the Lakeland poets. I guess Faust's real struggle is with himself, and then when he creates this creature, then he's got the Faust Mephistopheles relationship with the monster.
He's a key figure for the Romantics, isn't he, Faust, Simon?
Absolutely.
I mean, why should that be when this is an increasingly kind of secular, almost atheistic moment, isn't it?
I think it's this sense that you have at the end of the 18th and beginning of the 19th century of boundless possibilities and of all the, as the cosmos begins to, in a sense, become more within our grasp, we begin to feel that all the things that have been forbidden, all the limits that have been placed, may fall completely. That is the great sense of the Victorian spirit, is that we are demigods. We can do anything. What we've built, the factories that we've built, and it's very interesting, Goethe's right up to the minute in Faust, in the second part of Faust, where they're reclaiming the sea, the land from the sea. Big kind of civil engineering works going on, and there is a sense that man becomes a god, in a sense. What is there to differentiate Faust from God if he can do everything and anything?
And this is an argument that we're still having, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. We're still saying we want to know more, we want to find out more, but if we find out too much, maybe we're going to destroy ourselves.
It's very interesting what you said about Frankenstein being his own Mephistopheles, in a sense. And you get the same thing in Jekyll and Hyde. They're two sides of the same coin. And Mephistopheles was almost equally attractive to the 19th century as Faust was. And you get no Faust music or Faust opera or whatever without its Mephistopheles. And there has to be without Mephistopheles, there's no Faust, really. And there is a curious sense that Faust and Mephistopheles become incredibly closely bound. It's a kind of a codependent relationship. They cannot really exist without each other. They nag each other like an old married couple. And Mephistopheles, by the end of it, is just exhausted by just serving this damn man who still won't be satisfied with anything.
Okay, well, I think it might be time for another reading from Goethe's Faust. John Rowe is going to read from the opening speech of the play.
Here I am, then. Philosophy behind me, law and medicine too, and, to my cost, theology. All studied, grimly sweated through. And here I sit, as big a fool as when I first attended school. True, I surpass the dull incompetence, doctors, pastors, and masters, and the rest, for whom there is no bliss but ignorance. But this preeminence I now detest. All my laborious studies only show that nothing is the most we ever know. Scruples I've laid aside, doubts as well. I have no fear of the devil or hell. And this is what robs me of all delight. I cannot boast that what I know is right. I cannot boast my teaching will ever find a way to improve or to convert mankind. Meanwhile, I live in poverty. No dog would choose to live like me. And so the rites of magic I rehearse to probe the secrets of the universe, to learn its mysteries and recognize the force that binds all nature's energies, to see creation's principles at work, and waste no more time on the trade of talk.
Thank you, John. Now, Simon, in 1988, you were giving that speech in the 7-hour uncut version of Goethe's Faust.
It was terribly cut. If we'd done the whole thing, it would have been the 24-hour version, which, thank God, it wasn't. But yes, I did indeed. It really brought it back to me, hearing it. A very elegant and witty translation by Robert David MacDonald. But in hearing that, I remembered again that one of the critical things about Faust, I think fairly central to the myth, is that he is constantly on the brink of despair. And that's another thing which was central to 19th century romantic feeling, was this sense of despair, of absolute disgust, of hopelessness, of having run out of reasons to live, the flavour of things having died, the taste of it all having gone. In a way, Faust is a self-portrait of Goethe. He was one of the most unstable human beings who ever lived. I think we have a sense of Goethe as being this absolute monolith, but in fact he was a man of most extraordinary fluidity.
How stable a character is Faustus, Mark? I mean, are all Fausts the same?
No, I think they're hugely, hugely different. This initial impulse, this initial yearning is there. But once he's off on this journey, particularly in the Goethe, I mean, it must be the most ambitious play ever written. I mean, Goethe was master of all these different disciplines, the last person that you could probably call the Renaissance man at a time where it was possible to know science and history and art and all of this stuff. But the play is so ambitious that it's always threatening to collapse under the weight of just how much stuff Goethe's trying to put into it. It's a hugely unstable structure that, and yet succeeds, it flies. And as a playwright, you look at it and you think, how the hell is this thing ever going to work? And somehow there is a magic there.
It must be said that virtually on his deathbed, Goethe said, never try to stage Faust.
I think it might be time to go to the audience at this point. So if you have any confession to make, any observation to make, any question to ask of our guests, then do stick your hand up. A microphone will whiz in your direction. Let's have a gentleman on the aisle.
I was wondering whether one of the attractions of the Faust myth, we've talked about the very deep bit of it, one of the attractive bits for playwrights and composers and things like that is you've got a lot of exciting episodes. You've got this deal, and then you can show what happens as a result of the deal, and it's all sort of exciting, getting drunk, having sex, blah-de-blah-de-blah.
The Guernsey play starts with this fantastic... There's a couple of prologues, but one between a theatre manager and an actor and a, yep. And a writer and the theatre manager saying, yep. Give me something with some fantastic spectacle in it. I've got some great scenery here that I want to show off. And that is one of the attractions of the story, is because it's so far-reaching, you can have some fantastic spectacle. And the production that Simon was in, one of the many fantastic things about it was it had those moments of spectacle.
Yeah.
And certainly for some, you know, the recent production of Berlioz's Damnation of Faust, that was one of the huge attractions of putting that piece on, is the possibility of spectacle.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. Across the, not only the globe, but also the universe. So you were in Goethe's Faust, the Walpurgisnacht. You know, you're actually on the top of that mountain with spirits and witches and so on. It does, you're right. I think it liberates you. It must liberate you as a writer. But any liberation of that kind is a prison of another kind, isn't it? Because if there are no limits to what you can write, then there's a danger that it'll all run away from you.
And I'm afraid that's where our time runs out. We didn't even get to hold hands with Helen of Troy. We did, however, enjoy the less forbidden pleasures of Simon Callow, Mark Ravenhill and John Rowe. So please, in the time you have left, do show your appreciation for them.
And welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Rob Cowan. In the second half of tonight's prom, there's just one work, which is both a symphony and a celebration of a composer who I always think of as scandalously underappreciated, or more accurately, widely celebrated for all the wrong reasons. His name, Franz Liszt, born 200 years ago this year, and whose range of invention stretches from finger-twisting piano showpieces to the stark pre-modernist statements of his later years. Liszt was one of the few composers who made the full pilgrimage from earthly to spiritual love, and you could say that what we're about to hear in a moment or two, his Faust Symphony, makes that journey manifest in a single work.
Liszt was more than just a very brilliant figure of his time. We are dealing with a piece of almost timeless dimensions, and certainly the meaning of this piece for the music of the 19th and 20th century is enormous.
It's almost as if it's philosophy without words, isn't it? Because you have the conflict between good and evil, you have the element of love which is central, so there are messages you can pick up from this music. I know there's the chorus Mysticus at the end, which brings in words and brings in a beautiful message, but there is so much that it actually says without using words at all.
I would call it Nietzsche called Wagner's Tristan Opus Metaphysicum. I would call this one Opus Metaphysicum, and maybe even Opus Mysticum, because the really mystical and unexplicable thing for me is how Liszt draws all those three diametrically opposed characters, Faust, Margarete, and Mephistopheles, out of one and the same theme. But the miracle is that it works. You do hear the differences between the Faust, between the love of Margarete, Gretchen, and then the devilishness of Mephistopheles. At the same time, it is one and the same thing. So this, for me, is pure metaphysics.
Vladimir Yurovsky, who also pointed out to me that Faust's theme underpins the entire work. It is, in fact, its main motive. And we meet Faust himself first, the philosopher who can't find fulfillment, a man racked by disillusionment and conflict, represented in music that's very much in keeping with Liszt's most passionate symphonic poems. So, in a sense, it's the second movement, a tender portrait of Gretchen, the sweet innocent whose beguiling tone poetry bears a resemblance to Liszt's beautiful symphonic poem Orpheus. And lastly, in this Faust symphony by Liszt, there's the devil in the pack, Mephistopheles himself, the trickster, shadowy, unpredictable, quixotic, and the inspiration behind what's probably the symphony's most inventive music. Interesting that according to Goethe, the devil can't create, only destroy. So Liszt doesn't actually give him any original themes. He just takes Faust's themes, then twists and mutilates them into distorted parodies to show Mephistopheles actually acting through Faust. But although Faust is discomfited, he's not defeated, and a sudden transition elevates us to the a cappella chorus mystica heralded by the organ, and where a tenor soloist, Marco Jentsch, in tonight's performance, enters with the Gretchen motive, the message being that all things are transitory. Well, here at the Hall, a very interesting and impressive spectacle. The men of the London Symphony Chorus and the London Philharmonic Choir, 50 or so on the stage and another 120 ranged on the tiers behind, about 160, 170 altogether. And now the applause here at the Royal Albert Hall for the conductor, Vladimir Yurovsky, who together with the tenor Marco Jentsch, the men's voices of the London Symphony Chorus and the London Philharmonic Choir and the London Philharmonic Orchestra perform Liszt's A Faust Symphony.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
that is past of us was but reflected. All that was lost in us here is corrected. All indescribables here we descry it. Woman's divinity leads us on high. Lewis McNeice translation of Goethe's Faust. And that was Liszt's orchestral masterpiece, his Faust Symphony. The tenor soloist was Marco Jentsch, with the men of the London Symphony Chorus and the London Philharmonic Choir and the London Philharmonic Orchestra under their principal conductor, Vladimir Yurovsky. What I found so beautiful about that performance was the control of line that Yurovsky displayed in all the quieter music, especially Gretchen, the middle movement, and the drama was magnificently projected, I thought. Impressive orchestral discipline from the members of the London Philharmonic, and such wonderful principals as well. Ian Hardwick, oboe, the guest principal viola, Tom Dunn, trumpet, Paul Beniston, Peter Schumann, of course, the leader, and Nicholas Carpenter, clarinet. And here Neville Creed, who directed the choruses, takes a bow. And here is Marco Jentsch. Huge chap, very imposing. He claps and applauds the choir himself. And Vladimir Yurovsky returns, triumphant in this music. Not an easy work to pull together, as great as it is. But he certainly managed. Principal strings are asked to stand. They did such lovely work. And he cues various principal woodwinds that I've just mentioned, and players from the orchestra. Well, a very memorable prom. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. On Monday night, you can hear Liszt's other great symphony on a literary theme, his Dante Symphony, with the BBC Philharmonic under their outgoing principal conductor, Gianandrea Noseda. A programme that also includes music by Beethoven and Saint-Saëns' Egyptian Piano Concerto. But now, time to hand you back to Jill Anderson at Broadcasting House for the rest of this evening's listening.
Thank you very much. That was Rob Cowan at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on Radio 3. And I should also mention that Liszt is our Composer of the Week this week, and you can hear the next episode of that programme tomorrow at noon, repeated at 6:30. Well, we've two programmes about opera this evening. At 10:45 in the essay, Matt Peacock, originator of the community opera project Streetwise, reflects on the way opera's changed the lives of people he's met during the past 10 years. But now, in tonight's feature on Radio 3, the musician Claire Van Campen goes on a journey back to the beginnings of the operatic tradition in England. The setting is unlikely. The country has been ravaged by civil war, the king has been beheaded, and the theatres have all been closed by order of the Puritan Parliament. Step forward Sir William Davenant, cavalier rake and political opportunist, to mount the first English opera.
If you ask people, what's the first English opera? They'll probably say John Blow's Venus and Adonis, or Henry Purcell's Dido and Aeneas. Good answers, but both wrong. In fact, England's first opera was The Siege of Rhodes, and it was performed publicly more than two decades earlier, in 1656. It's an amazing story. especially when you consider that the work's librettist, Sir William Davenant, was a fervent royalist and the theatres had officially been closed for more than a decade when it was first performed. How did such a seminal event come to pass under Oliver Cromwell's supposedly anti-dramatic republic? That's one of the questions I want to try to answer. And it brings centre stage one of the great forgotten heroes of the English theatre, William Davenant. Some might say Davenant was the man who invented not only English opera, but also the idea of William Shakespeare, the national poet. Another question I want to address is, what did the Siege of Rhodes actually sound like? I'm particularly interested in this because I spent many years exploring Renaissance stage music at Shakespeare's Globe. I'll be meeting up with some of the country's finest opera singers to see if we can resurrect the musical spirit of the Siege. It's the first time that's been attempted since Samuel Pepys tried it, almost 350 years ago. The score to the Siege of Rhodes has long been lost, but we know enough about the musical context and the composers involved to perhaps get a flavour of what they were up to.
Still a new plot, or at least an old trick. We English were wont to be simple and true, but every man now is a Florentine meek. A little Peugeot for a great Richelieu.
1642 was a watershed year for English dramatists. The theatres were closed down, and playwrights like William Davenant, by then poet laureate, found themselves out of a job. One of the great opponents of the theatre, and another key player in our story, was Oliver Cromwell, whose rise to political eminence swept away so many traditional pastimes of 17th century Britain. To find out a bit more about the impact Cromwell's ascent had on Davenant and other artists, I travelled to Cromwell's house, which is now a museum, in Ely, to speak to Dr. Dawn Lewcock, who has studied Davenant over many years.
Though the theatres had been closed, there were still some players in London, and they would open up the Red Bull. Occasionally they'd have a troop of soldiers burst in, take them all off to the guardhouse, and there are reports of them being dragged through the streets in their costumes to the mockery of the general public. But they still tried, bless them. Cromwell liked music. He had concerts in his own house. It was the actual drama, the plays, that the Puritan view was not wicked exactly, but it was feigning something that wasn't true. It was giving people illusions that were wrong, and therefore this was a bad thing to do.
Obviously, the Civil War had a major impact on court writers like Davenant. What happened to him and his peers during this period?
Well, Davenant himself was a gunrunner, actually. He had 14 years away from writing and was an emissary between the king and the queen, and was also fighting up in Yorkshire at a time. But once the regicide happened, he went off to Paris with Henrietta Maria and set to writing his great epic poem, which he never finished, called Gondibert. But then Charles II made him the lieutenant governor of Maryland, which was then an English colony, and he was setting off to go there in a boat in the Channel and was captured by the Commonwealth Navy. I think they had one boat, and was taken back to London and put in the Tower. And it said that he was about to be executed but was saved by John Milton.
How well was he known?
Very well known, actually. He was the poet laureate after Ben Jonson. He'd written some 10 plays and 4 or 5 masks for court. He himself, actually, is a very interesting character because he came from very humble beginnings. He turned up in London aged 16 in 1622 with an inheritance that his father thought was going to be put to giving him an apprenticeship in a trade. Instead of which, he made his way to one of the best tailors in town and bought himself a really good outfit and somehow or other managed to become in the household of the Duchess of Richmond, where he started his long climb into the court circle.
Now, in the 1630s, it was rumoured that Davenant had died. Can you tell me about that?
Well, he disappeared from court for about 3 years, and it's thought he must have had syphilis, and he went retired to the countryside to get better. We think he must have been treated with mercury, The only portrait we've got of him shows him with this funny little snub nose with a break in it, a great dip in it. And he was mocked for this. Oh. He even that late on, in a collection of his poems, where they always put these commentatory poems by his friends at the beginning, and one of them mocks him for this and because he put an apostrophe in his name. Oh. When he started, it was D-A-V-E-N-A-N-T. By his second play, on the title page, he'd got D apostrophe capital A V-E-N-A-N-T.
Davenant.
Davenant, yes. And he said he was probably a Lombard because the play was about Lombardy.
Fantastic.
But this is what the part of the poem said. Some say by Avenant no place is meant, and that this Lombard is without descent. And as by bilk, meaning to bilk your bill, of course, men mean there's nothing there. So come from Avenant means from nowhere. So Will, intending Davenant to grace, has made a notch in's name like in's face.
One of the ways in which Davenant had marked himself out at court prior to the Civil War was as a writer of masks. Might these have shaped his operatic experiments in the 1650s? Martin Butler is Professor of English Renaissance Drama at Leeds University.
Court masks are a form that were historically involved with the princely courts of 16th and 17th century Europe. They were a form of festivity that went hand in hand with the displays of prestige and financial and political power that European princes were keen to promote. Davenant produced a series of masks celebrating King Charles and Henrietta Maria. In his mask Britannia Triumphans, King Charles is introduced in the character of Britannocles, the heroic ruler of Britain. And the final scene shows the British fleet tacking to and fro across a serene sea. And this was an allusion to ship money, the unparliamentary tax that Charles was endeavouring to levy at this time. It's very tempting to think of the Siege of Rhodes as a direct descendant of Davenant's mask writing. In fact, in some ways, it's rather different. Masks were more like variety shows. They didn't tell stories in the complex way that the Siege of Rhodes was to do. However, the key departures in the Siege of Rhodes, that is, the music and particularly the scenery, which was the other aspect of the performance that contemporaries commented on, these were things that Davenant would have been very accustomed to working with in the court mask. And he was also working with a group of people who had been intimately involved in the production of masks. Two of his composers, Charles Coleman and Henry Laws, had written music for masks before the Civil War. The scenery was designed by John Webb, who was Inigo Jones's assistant and who had helped him work on the later masks. And there may even have been money put into it by a lawyer, Sir John Maynard, who was a friend of Davenant's, but who had also written masks himself as a kind of amateur writer in the 1620s.
Having made the short journey from Ely to Cambridge, I'm now in Magdalen College, where I'm about to meet Dr. Richard Luckett, the Pepys librarian. So the reason we're here is that we're on a bit of a treasure trail about the Siege of Rhodes. We're trying to discover the history of it, the roots of it, and eventually what parts of it may have sounded like.
Do come in.
Oh, Dr. Luckett, how nice to meet you. Good afternoon.
So here you are in the Pepys Library with Pepys's books exactly as he wished them to be left at his death.
So what are we looking at here?
We're looking at one of Pepys's songbooks. And these were compiled for him by his domestic musician and reader in foreign tongues, Cesare Morelli. And you will notice the very large writing.
Yes, it's very large, isn't it? And beautifully, clearly written out with lots of spacing between the notes. Very unlike the way that manuscript of this period often looks. It's very clear.
Absolutely. It's completely different. And that is because Pepys was having major problems with his eyes.
Yes.
That's why he stopped writing the diary. But he didn't realise that his problem was not so much with his eyes as with his ophthalmologist.
I see.
Who was treating him for short sight when what he was suffering from was mixed astigmatism and yes, long sight. And so here, in amongst Pepys's favourite songs for singing, Maidle Luli, in fact, there is his own song, which is Beauty Retire and is a setting from the Siege of Rhodes.
Yes, I'm reading the label here. It says Beauty Retire, Diary, 6th of December, 1665. I spent the afternoon upon a song of Soliman's words to Roxolana that I have set.
Retire, thou dost my pity move. Believe my pity and then trust my love. At first I thought her by our prophet sent.
Can you explain a little more about the connection between them? Was it just an admiration of Davenant's penmanship that Pepys admired? Or do you think it was the combination of the music that he heard with Davenant's text that clearly meant that he retained this information for us?
I think that it's quite clear from Pepys's diary that he was carried away by the music. And it was something that he wanted to somehow reinstitute when he discovered that he couldn't actually find it. He sought the company of the people who'd been involved in the Siege of Rhodes when it was performed in Rutland House, in Davenant's house. It had obviously been a formative experience, and in a way he sought to reconstitute it.
So there's a portrait, isn't there, with a particular connection to Davenant?
The original is in the National Portrait Gallery, and the painting of it is described in the diary. And the wonderful thing is that now with X-rays, they've been able to follow the whole business through. And what Pepys was desperate to do was to get Hales to show Beauty Retire, which is what he's holding in his hand.
So there's a connection.
To show it adequately. And Hales was, because of for simple painterly reasons, looking at it from a rather different point of view. And Pepys went to great lengths to get him to turn it round, and all of this can be demonstrated from X-rays.
So we're stepping outside the library to have a look at the copy of this portrait hanging outside. So here it is, and there he's holding a copy of Beauty Retire, I see.
So that you can read the words, and indeed you could sing the music up to a point, though it's rather occluded there.
At first I thought her by our prophet sent, as a reward for valor's toils, more worth than all my father's spoils.
Davenant really specialised in sailing close to the wind.
Yes.
And obviously to do a musically staged play which got rid around the ban on stage plays because it was to music, and so it was interludes, and very careful to call them entries, not acts. If he'd said acts, then a play in five acts, it would have been a play. But an entertainment in five entries was something different again.
That's very politically astute, isn't it? That's someone who's learned a method of survival as an artist and an entrepreneur.
I think that Pepys probably lived with the regret that he had not actually found the music for the Siege of Rhodes to the very end of his life.
Well, let's hope we can provide something that he might be pleased to hear.
Well, and I do not believe it impossible that something might turn up You never know.
What a tantalising idea, that the music to The Siege of Rhodes, the first English opera, might be sitting unidentified somewhere, gathering dust in someone's attic. After all, it was only 20 years ago that another Davenant-related document was discovered. This was a pamphlet entitled A Proposition for Advancement of Morality, and it appeared to answer a question that had long baffled theatre historians. How did the ultra-royalist Davenant manage to obtain permission from his seeming enemies, the Cromwellians, and put on an opera at perhaps the least propitious moment in the history of the English stage? One of the academic detectives responsible for making the discovery, Professor Tim Rayler, takes up the story from his base in Minnesota.
The document filled a bit of a biographical gap, a gap in our knowledge of what Davenant had been doing. Because Davenant had been arrested on his way to Maryland, where he'd been appointed lieutenant governor. He'd been taken by the Commonwealth authorities and thrown into prison. And he'd spent quite a bit of time in the Tower of London, where he was fearing execution. But then he'd been released, and we didn't really know very much about this period after his release. What was he actually up to, apart from being intermittently arrested for debt? And it became clear then from the document what he was up to. And what he was up to was trying to provide an intellectual and ideological rationale for the first English opera. Davenant doesn't use the word opera in A Proposition for Advancement of Morality, but it's clear from what he talks about that he's talking about the genre of work that he will later call opera. Now, the opera, he says, is going to render the people morally and politically virtuous. It's going to render them valiant abroad and compliant at home. And he bases the argument for how it's going to do this on a thoroughly mechanistic psychology, which he seems to have adapted from his reading of recent writings by the philosophers Thomas Hobbes and René Descartes, writings on the passions. And according to Davenant's version of this mechanist psychology, the common people, ordinary folk, are not truly rational, and they learn primarily through sense impressions. So the argument is that the way to educate the people is to work on their senses through powerful multimedia spectacles, which will relate politically correct stories of English martial valour and obedience to authority, through a powerful combination of words and music, visual spectacle with movable scenery and moving lights, transpositions of lights, with a view to indoctrinating the audience.
Tim Rayler of Carleton College, on the complex behind-the-scenes machinations that allowed Davenant's operatic experiment to go ahead. Back in London, the scene of Davenant's greatest triumphs, I decided to go to my old professional home, The Globe on Bankside. There I met up with Professor Andrew Gurr to talk about Davenant's links to another rather better remembered William, Shakespeare.
So Andy, can you tell me, how does Davenant fit into the Shakespeare story?
He really remade Shakespeare for the Restoration and for centuries after that. He musicalized it, of course, as you know all too well. And he was probably the chief inspiration for the elevation of Shakespeare, the effect of making Shakespeare more popular than the rivals of his period, Beaumont and Fletcher and Ben Jonson.
Davenant, of course, trained one of the great Shakespearean actors, Thomas Betterton. Can you tell us a bit about him?
Betterton was the great actor of the Restoration period. There's actually a wonderful quotation from the stage manager of the King's Company, the non-Betterton company of the two that were set up in the Restoration, who wrote about his 40 years of working as stage manager for the King's men of that time. He said, for instance, that this is John Downes, who wrote a book called Roscius Anglicanus, he said that Betterton he'd seen playing Henry VIII in the Shakespeare version in 1663, and he said of that the part of the king was so right and justly done by Mr. Betterton, he being instructed by Sir William Davenant, who had it from old Mr. Lowen, that had his instructions from Mr. Shakespeare himself. This is the genealogy of inheriting things from Shakespeare himself. I think that's a bit questionable because it's a rather lengthy lineage, But nonetheless, that was what was being claimed by Davenant and the others as the inheritance of the great tradition from the King's Men before the Restoration.
There's a rumour, isn't there, that Davenant was actually the son of William Shakespeare, playwright and actor?
Yes, there is a rumour. It was actually propagated by Davenant himself, so it's clearly a rumour he liked. His parents were innkeepers in Oxford, at the Crown Inn in Oxford, and his mother was reputedly very beautiful and very famous for being so beautiful. And Davenant himself liked the idea that Shakespeare, on his treks up from London to Stratford and back, must have stayed at the inn. It was a nice idea anyway. I mean, he really was emphasising that he was Shakespeare's spiritual descendant as an author and playwright rather than anything else. But nonetheless, it was something he was quite pleased to have announced, and Aubrey recorded it as one of the many legends about the time.
Davenant's work after the Restoration may have made him the heir to Shakespeare, but did his relations with the government in the 1650s also turn this ultra-royalist into a Cromwellian collaborator? Dr. Marcus Knevitt is a lecturer in Renaissance literature at the University of Sheffield.
I think that process of turning, if you like, starts earlier in the 1650s. So with a poem like Gondibert, which is an overtly royalist work in lots of ways, in the preface to that poem, Davenant's keen to secure the place of wit in the creative process, and that's he's trying to make that a royalist thing. It's a royalist, the cause of wit is a royalist thing, and he's defining that against something like inspiration, which for him is tainted, dirtied by associations with radical Puritanism and sectarianism. So Gondibert and wit clearly mark it out as royalist, but what's interesting, at the same time as he's saying that Gondibert's a royalist poem, he's also sending out copies of the poem to people from all points on the political scale. So he's given it to royalists like the Duke of Newcastle, but he's also giving copies of his poem to people like John Selden, a polymathic MP who has some sympathy with non-monarchical regimes, and the Leveller leader John Wildman. So there's a sense in which he clearly thinks that Gondibert can play with non-royalists too. And the peculiar way in which Gondibert appeared, the preface appeared a month before the poem, and Davenant was mercilessly satirised for this, because what's the point of having a preface to a poem if the